The views expressed on this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
Clearly, equity was the problem. If SVB or Credit Suisse had, you know, meaningfully measured, 20% equity, the losses would have been absorbed.
That was Anat Admati, a Stanford professor who became the bête noire of the banking system after the last financial crisis by arguing that giant lenders are addicted to debt and prone to dumping their losses on taxpayers. A decade later, she thinks the risks are even clearer. Welcome to The Exchange. I'm Liam Proud from Reuters Breaking Views. I spoke to Anat last week in London, where she came to promote the new chapters of her book, The Banker's New Clothes. We reflect on the collapses of Credit Suisse and Silicon Valley Bank from a year ago, and dive into the new US bank capital rule fight, known as the Basel Endgame. Unsurprisingly, Anat has strong views. Listen on to hear them. So, Anat, thank you for being here. So you wrote your original book sort of in the wake of what happened in 2008 and the regulatory response to it. You've now added some chapters. Why have you done that now? I mean, didn't we kind of fix banking over the last 10 years?
We did it. And that's part of why we wanted to write this. A decade elapsed. So we looked around. Interest rates were increasing. This is summer 2022. And we know that interest rate increases, given the fragility of the system, could take.
So you thought about doing it before SVB and
Credit Suisse collapsed? Oh, definitely. SVB and Credit Suisse just fell into our hands as we were trying to wrap up the writing. Originally, we were just going to spend a couple of months in the fall of 2022 in order for the book to appear in 2023, which was the decade since the first edition. It came in 2013 with the paperback 2014. So we kind of had the decade of 2013 to 14, early 2013 to 14 to kind of that you could call a decade after. Yeah. And so we thought of a 2023 edition, which would say, guess what? You know, be wary of interest rate increases and watch out for the too big to fail ones, particularly Credit Suisse. So we had our eyes on Credit Suisse as the sort of zombie of the day, as the one to watch, because it accumulated all these losses and all of that. So that is how we started writing in fall 2022.
Right. So let's kind of start with a challenge about last year then. I mean, the absolute core of your book the first time around was that banks should fund themselves with more equity and less debt, you know, i.e. deposits and bonds and things like that. If you compared Silicon Valley Bank and Credit Suisse, the two banks that failed last year, to their rivals. In relative terms, they didn't seem like the most obviously undercapitalized banks out there. You know, Credit Suisse had just raised 4 billion Swiss francs. So, I mean, was equity really the problem here?
Of course equity was a problem. If they had more equity, they would have been able to absorb their losses without causing all this trouble, without needing, you know, without having a depositor run in both cases, a slow one, a fast one, whatever. And without needing all these interventions and all these bailouts. So clearly, equity was the problem. If SVB or Credit Suisse had, you know, meaningfully measured, 20% equity, the losses would have been absorbed. You know, bad management in the case of Credit Suisse, bad business model, interest rate risk, taking down treasuries with very little equity in SVB.
And not hedging the interest rate.
And not hedging the interest rate. So, gambling all the way. And, risk and debt. And it didn't work out.
So how do you think about equity in relation to what bankers call liquidity risk? I mean, what it seems like what happened with those two banks, it was a classic bank run in a way, right? Yeah. With Credit Suisse,
That's the favorite narrative.
Yeah, it was wealthy people in Asia predominantly pulling their money out of the private bank. In Silicon Valley Bank, it was, VCs and tech startups putting their money out. Like, how does that relate to equity requirements? Because it feels like the natural place to go based on Credit Suisse and Silicon Valley Bank is to look at the structure of the deposits and why wasn't there enough assets to make those requests good?
Well, the question is, when the assets lose value and the deposits and others want to be paid and they have claims that they can withdraw, What happens then? So in banking, they always like to go in the plumbing liquidity.
Yeah.
And they always like that narrative. So the word is very pervasive.
So what does it mean then?
So let me explain. Liquidity has to do with your ability to convert your assets to cash when you need it.
Mm.
Okay. So the assets might be liquid. It could be, you know, an island somewhere. It could be a business loan maybe. Or it could be a security. You know, a treasury is very liquid. The problem with it was that it actually lost value.
Mm.
So the way to describe the liquidity problems that happened, the runs, is that the bank, both cases, became insolvent. And because of that, people wanted their money out before the other person gets their money out. And that was a perfectly rational response to the fact that you're concerned that you might not get paid. Now, if you're an insured depositor, you probably think you will be paid. But in the case of Credit Suisse, there were a lot of foreign depositors, and they were effectively uninsured because deposit insurance would not necessarily. This is like what happened with Icelandic banks, which had depositors in Amsterdam and in London that were not insured by Iceland. You know, and then they had to be covered by governments elsewhere and then had to haggle it with Iceland, which wouldn't pay. Yeah. In the case of Switzerland, of the Credit Suisse, their deposit insurance was very incomplete, not even fully backed and only covering Swiss depositors. And in any case, and in SVB, clearly 95% of depositors were not insured. And they rationally figured out that the bank was insolvent because the bank had to recognize some losses when it sold some assets that lost value, even though the accounting rules allowed them to hide some of the losses. It became clear that their losses were going to wipe out their equity. And that was even clear from disclosures months before, which nobody was paying attention to. And then they also had the absolute, you know, death sentence of being unable to raise equity, which is really where you know somebody is in deep hole of debt when nobody will pay for their equity. And that's what happened to SVB when it became completely obvious that their bank was no good. Then social media helped create a modern version of a run. Instead of people lining up outside the bank, they were on their apps and $42 billion escaped and the bank was dead.
So just to recap, so because there is a narrative about those two rescues, about those two situations where it says, you know, it was kind of a classic bank run, you know, they funded themselves with types of deposits which could easily leave. And, you know, the solution would therefore be to, you know, change the way banks fund their deposits or to sort of, you know, make sure they have more liquid cash on hand to meet those deficits. You say that puts the cart before the horse. The wrong way around. The money
assets
left because they didn't have enough equity.
Exactly. Yeah. Because they didn't have enough equity given that they were losing on their assets. Yeah. Having liquid assets won't help you from insolvency.
Yeah.
It just won't. So you can say, oh, have liquid assets, have cash reserve in the central bank. I mean, if you want to park everything there, good luck to you getting returns on anything. So, or at least the returns you
maybe
like
last year that was
have,
a good strategy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, the money was put at risk. Never mind the liquidity at all, because here is the key point: we created central banks in order to solve what you might call pure liquidity problems. So, if you have good assets that you just can't convert to cash fast enough, then we have a bank for you. Your bank as a bank is a central bank. And you go there and give your good assets as collateral to that, and they'll give you liquidity.
This is the lender of last resort.
Exactly.
Familiar.
So the lender of last resort says for solvent banks with collateral assets that are good, they don't have to be liquid. They'll take it and give you liquidity. So if you're solvent, there's no problem. So we don't even need liquidity requirements. We need to make solvency less of a problem, and only equity will do that.
I mean, so there's another element of, you know, this what people are calling the Basel endgame, which is a sort of, you know, the sort of insider kind of way of talking about the final leg of bank capital reform is the way it gets talked about. Now, it was being cooked up long before everything that happened last year, but it's very much become part of the debate. And this is a, you know, it's really a US thing, the kind of European equivalent, the sort of a little bit more
finalization.
Yeah. What's your response to the pretty clear message that comes out of the banking system, which is that if you do this, if you raise our capital requirements, make us fund various loans with more equity, it will hurt lending in the economy at a very difficult, risky moment for the economy. I mean, why is that not the case?
So Basel III is where I started waking up to the problems.
This is the original
reforms. The original 2010. Yeah. So the first actions we took were to warn that Basel III is badly designed, maintains a poor design of the regulation, has to do with these complex risk weights that are kind of baked into this sort of risk-based rules. And so it took a regulation, Basel II, that was absolutely disastrous and tweaked it in small ways. And it was entirely inadequate. So in 2010, right as they were signing this Basel III agreement in Seoul, South Korea, we published a letter of 20 academics saying that Basel III is a disaster. And in that piece, we said, if you need at least 15% equity to total assets, non-risk-weighted assets, risk-weighted assets
the
are much
ratio,
less because some assets are considered zero risk. Like treasuries, even though they can lose in value when interest rates change, which is crazy. But anyway, so that the social benefits of that would be huge. The social costs would be hard to find if we don't find it. So it's a complete bargain from a regulatory perspective. It just brings benefits at no relevant cost. Other regulations, including liquidity regulations, could be quite costly to maintain on a regular basis and quite useless when you need them because all of a sudden, you know, it's a run and not a normal demand. And all of a sudden, the assets that were considered liquid might freeze, which is what happened in the crisis. So there is all kinds of complex rules that are not, the cost benefit is not there. But for capital regulations, at least sort of the way we want them, which is simple ratios, but very safe and sound, There's a lot of benefits and no cost to be seen for a while. In other words, if banks, for example, do not pay dividends and buy back shares, which is what Europeans did during COVID, despite the screaming of the banks,
the capital ratios go up.
They have more money to lend. So how is it that if you just paid the dividend or high bonus to your employees and you didn't pay that bonus in equity, you paid it in cash, and so there you depleted your cash. How come if you tell me that you can't make a loan if I tell you to stop doing that, to just keep the money there? Now, many companies in the world, especially, you know, growth companies, tech companies, they don't pay dividends for years and years. Mm. Warren Buffett didn't pay dividends for many, many years. And he grows and the stock price goes up because he makes good investments on behalf of his investors, and they're happy, and the stock price goes up. So what are the banks saying? They don't have good investments? Mm. If they retain their earnings, they should just invest them on behalf of their equity holders, and what's the problem? They shouldn't burn the money, obviously. They should invest it. They can make loans. So if anything, if you have more equity in the form of adding equity, because we in our writings, we also say that adjusting to ratio can be inefficient. But if you take them by the hand into having more amount of equity, not even a ratio. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the problem? If you issue equity and you retain your earnings, what's the problem?
I mean, I can imagine what a bank CEO would say if they were sitting here. They'd say the what they would call the equity story, the investment case for big listed banks, you know, in Europe and America, has sort of become, we are these big dividend payers. We're capital returning stocks, right? We are, you know, you buy us, you buy BNP Paribas, JP Morgan, whatever, you get this dividend and you get this buyback. And that's kind of, that's the thing. We're not tech companies. We're not growing like that. We're sending it out the door. So would it not kind of ruin the investment case to do
well,
that?
I teach corporate finance. And when we teach corporate finance, we also talk about the irrelevancy of dividends. Because, you know, a publicly traded company, if they didn't pay the dividends, the investor can sell a few shares and get themselves payout because the money still stays on the balance sheet. Mm. So the money still belongs to the shareholders and they can create their own homemade dividend then. And that is absolute basics. So what it says is that the corporation, the bank, keeps it, therefore is available for the creditors. The shareholders are free to get themselves cash out of there, but in the cash and all the retained earnings are still theirs as long as that is paid. Mm. And that's how it should be. In other words, by doing that, they're essentially doing a little bit more self-insurance of their debts so that they're not putting their creditors and the rest of the economy at risk as much. So there's a lot of the claims they make. And, you know, here is a document that accompanies the book, available on our website and in a lot of places, called The Parade of Bankers' New Clothes Continues, because the title of the book, The Bankers' New Clothes, refers to the Hans Christian Andersen the emperor's new clothes, in which, there was no substance to the clothes. And what we refer to by bankers' new clothes is claims about banking that have no substance, that are flawed in some way, false, misleading, mythical, whatever. And so after writing the book, we kept hearing the same claims. So it's as if the emperor keeps marching down the street despite having been called naked. And we called it the Parade of Bankers' New Clothes Continues. And we started with 23 flawed claims, a list of claims and a short debunk. Mm-hmm. With a reference to longer debunking. And by now, the document has gained 44 distinct flawed claims because they keep coming up with them. There are sometimes variations, but it's something that you might hear in the debate and something is wrong with it. And so it become exhausting to keep track of all of them. Mm-hmm. And there are more outrageous ones that get born on a regular basis I couldn't make up myself, but when they come up, I say, "Oh, really? You're really saying that?" For example, groceries will go up if you increase capital requirements. Right. Quoting, using the term Basel Endgame because nobody in the public even understands what this is, and well, they would confuse you about what it is.
Let's talk about the substance of it then. So we've just had a discussion about overall equity levels in the banking system going up shouldn't really make a difference to whether or not banks are lending more or less than
if you do it correctly. If you design the rules properly, then you are sort of taking care of whatever might be a transitional shrinkage or cut in loans or whatever, because you're now saying you have more funds to lend. Just
but
go
given,
lend them.
Given what the rules on the table are, mm-hmm. and obviously they're being changed.
Yeah.
I mean, don't some of the arguments are maybe a little bit more credible than mm-hmm. that overall one, where you'd say, okay, we have this rule book and it's probably not going to be, burnt mm-hmm. down and just become a very mm-hmm. straightforward, simple rule that you would advocate. If you fiddle around with the treatment of credit cards versus XYZ thing, you could actually sensibly make an argument that this rule on the table will maybe affect some lending.
As it is right now, the system of risk weights generally does not
we should define what risk weights
are. So let me explain. You take all the investments of the bank and you split it up a million pieces. Okay. So each loan, each thing gets a weight attached to it. In a very extreme case, and it's sort of the exception that proves the rule, if a bank invested in like Bitcoin, like crypto, the risk weight was enormous. 1,250, which basically told the bank percent, so 12 and a half. Usually the risk weight is a fraction of one and sometimes zero. Mm. And so the risk weight is meant to say the following: take the asset, attach this weight to each one, and then add them up. So it's as if you ask the bank to fund a fraction of that particular investment with that much equity. Would say 8% is the rule for 100% risk weight for one. Mm. And then if it's zero, you don't need any equity. Mm. And if it's 12 and a half, you basically need full equity. In other words, 8 times 12.5% is 125% is 100%. So if you want, if a bank wants to invest in Bitcoin, it needs to fund it 100% with equity. It needs to be ready to absorb a full loss.
But if it holds U.S. government debt,
but if you hold government debt, if you hold Greek government debt in Europe, you know, if you hold a AAA rated security, you need no equity funding. So it gets eliminated from the denominator of whatever is the ratio we're talking about. So the ratio is some kind of measure of not even equity, but a tiered one capital, whatever is the technical term, divided by this risk-weighted assets. Now, what they're doing in the entire debate is they're tweaking some risk weights up, which effectively says in order to maintain a ratio of, say, 8% or whatever, you need a little bit more equity at the top because the denominator is getting bigger. Mm-hmm. So now they want, for example, more equity for what they call operational risk. So what's operational risk? Well, it's a part of the book that's really important. It's about all the fines they pay for all these breaking of rules and all these, you know, enabling of Epstein or, you know, Madoff, or money laundering, or fraud, you know, consumer fraud, all kinds of fraud that they pay fines for. Well, you got to have money to pay those fines. In fact, the authorities often take pity on you if you don't have money or if you're systemic, because God forbid, you know, we give you too big a fine and cause some collateral harm. So you're kind of too big to jail or too big to fine. And so, yeah, you should have some in equity funding money you don't owe to fund those fines just in case you break the law again, which you keep doing. So, you know, the screaming from the banks is really quite shocking, because they're actually saying we must take the money out all the time. Yeah. You know, we don't want to invest it on behalf of our investors. And that is somehow a failure of a business model, or an admission that the business model depends too much on subsidies.
So, to be clear, and you're thinking about the Basel Endgame, which again, just to reiterate, is this, you know, latest tranche of bank regulation rules.
The 1,000 pages rule.
It's incredibly hard to get through. Yep. I can tell you from experience. I'm sure you've had.
Oh yeah. It is crazy.
You would concede maybe that it's possible that fiddling around with these risk weights as the rules do,
could all kinds of distortions.
Do funny things. But your
risk weights usually favor government anyway. Right. So they are against lending. Of course, the banks will threaten they won't make a particular loan. But, you know, you can't hold them to those threats or promises anyway. Yeah. They'll do what they'll do.
But your favorite option would be to sort of, you know, throw a match to the whole thing and not have risk weights and just have large amounts of equity.
I would rely more on simple metrics. If you have risk weights in some risk adjustment in some fashion, that would be the backstop. Right now, what they're doing is they're relying mostly on risk-based metrics. And then they have the leverage ratio as a kind of
like a
backstop. But the numbers are ridiculous. 3%, 4%, 5%. You know, these numbers don't have enough digits. I mean, these numbers don't make any sense. No healthy company lives like that.
How should they live in your sort of ideal vision of the world? What I mean, because it sometimes feels like, or at least there's a narrative out there that, you know, we're trying to, you know, people like you are trying to make it the banking system less risky. It can't do this. It can't do that. It can't do that. And
no,
at some point, it's not
anything,
a bank anymore.
As long as it funds it with equity that can absorb losses. I don't want to control their investments.
Yeah.
That's the point. I come from Silicon Valley, and taking risk is fine. You know, compare the financial crisis of 2007 to 9 to the internet bubble burst. So internet was, you know, getting a lot, very hyped up in the late 1990s, you know, 90s, early noughts. And then it crashed massively. Now, a ton of money got lost in the stock market, and it wasn't a big global recession and bailouts. People lost money because the investments weren't as profitable or as successful as people believed they might be. And so, but it was a correction of a sort of an internet bubble of some sort, which was not accompanied by debt, which was all about equity, you know, values being reduced. And it didn't have all the contagion and all this interconnected and all this fragility. And it was fine. A lot more money, you know, paper money profits were was lost then than losses on subprime defaults, you know, there were excessive lending, by the way. Whenever they say lending is always good, look at subprime lending. And in not just in the U.S., but also in, you know, Ireland or other countries, to see that not all lending is always good. We have lending that's not that good. So the notion that credit is something we love and, God forbid, can't do without, or that we can't fund appropriately priced loans with equities is false and wrong. And so, you know, there's just a lot of nonsense in this whole debate.
Okay, final question. So, I mean, another thing that's changed a huge amount since the last kind of financial crisis is the rise of what people call shadow banks, non-bank financial intermediaries, you know, whatever you would call it. We're talking about money market funds, yep, insurers, private credit, hedge funds. How does that change your view, if at all, about the risk in the banking system?
So shadow banking from the beginning was, in another way of calling it, is regulatory arbitrage. So money market funds were sort of the original shadow bank. It was at a time, they grew up in the 70s originally, at a time when interest rates were high, but in the US there was a regulation that constrained interest rates paid by the banks. And so in order to get market interest rates, depositors started leaving the banks into the money market funds until that regulation was stopped. But by then, you already had the money market funds. Now, money market funds illustrate the issue perfectly, because money market funds are just inserting themselves in the middle between the end investor, the depositor, say, the saver, and the bank, because they, or something else, because what you give the money to the money market fund gives the bank a, you know, short-term loan. So all of a sudden, if you, you know, the money market fund then pretends to be a bank, because it tells you that a dollar is guaranteed, that's in the US, and they can't break the buck. And you think that it's as pretty much as liquid from your perspective, meaning convertible to cash, as a deposit is, which is a very liquid, you know, investment. So we saw in the crisis that there was sort of money market funds created sort of a double run, then run on the banks. And oftentimes, you know, if there are tremors and losses, they will withdraw their funding, and their investors can withdraw from them. And so they just become another source of fragility in the system. And then they end up getting bailed out. And that's what happened in the financial crisis. And that's what happened again in COVID, despite a promise that we will have better regulations for them, because they were classified. So this is where you get into the complexity and the fragmentation of the regulation. If you define a bank by as a bank, you're regulated by these people. And if you define as a mutual fund, even though you promised a dollar, you know, you're regulated by the SEC. And then the SEC is subject to all this lobbying about their regulation, which failed in 2014, only to be seen in 2020 COVID. And now they revised it once again. The other, you know, the other shadow bank is often comes in two varieties, either institutions doing stuff in the financial sector and being less dangerous than the banks, less systemic and funded with more equity. So that includes mortgage lenders. In the US, there's a study that shows that non-bank mortgage lenders that don't fund with deposits.
Are we talking about Rocket Mortgage, Quicken Loans,
people
like that?
And they're funded with 20-30% equity. So, you know, only the banks are right at the edge, okay, because they can get away with it. But these people have to respond to investors. And so they're not as leveraged as the banks. They're not as indebted as the banks. So sometimes they're not as dangerous as the banks, and let the thousand, you know, shadow banks, you know, grow. And oftentimes, if they're dangerous, they so. But of course, hedge funds, even long-term capital management back in the AIG insurance, can become systemic. But the way they become systemic is their connection to the rest of the system. And so, you know, AIG had contracts with a lot of the banks to insure, you know, credit default swaps. And the way these contracts were structured, the banks like Citigroup or Goldman, they had priority over, you know, clients having, you know, life insurance. And so all of a sudden, you know, when there was a lot of payouts that AIG needed to make, that could have harmed the retail, you know,
the people who had insurance,
people who had insurance with them. And all of a sudden, they couldn't fail too. And so then they got bailed out, and the bankers to whom AIG owed money. The banks who took the risk that AIG would fail didn't actually lose.
So the take on shadow banking is, to the extent that they don't look anything like banks, they're fine. And to the extent
they
that it's worrying.
They might be fine. Yeah. To the extent that they're dangerous, they're often, if you follow the money, you'll find them right connected. What about other securitization vehicles? They would issue bonds, AAA, AA, all of that, and they would have liquidity backstops and the money market funds as well from their sponsors. And that is off balance sheet commitments that could come home to roost. And so the point being that there are a lot of risk taken, even by the regulated banks, going straight into that unregulated shadows. So the unregulated shadows are often living off of or attached to the privileged regulated ones. So you have to follow the money if you want to see how they even survive. Okay. Otherwise, they survive in markets and they might not be as bad.
Great. That's really useful. Thanks so much for your time, Annette. It's good to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
See you again.
Thanks for tuning in. This podcast was produced by Oliver Taslich in London. Subscribe to The Exchange and our sister podcast, The Views Room, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. Catch up with more of our views at breakingviews.com and on the X social media site, where our handle is @breakingviews.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.